Well, this was a exciting beginning to our first brown bag seminar of this spring semester. And we've got our, you know, gravity model for location folks, since the facilities management building is right there. you know, half a block away. But welcome, everybody. I wanted to just give a couple of announcements. On Friday, February 7th, Randy Walsh, who's professor of Department of Economics here at Pitt, will be talking about Chicago historic zoning research. And that is, again, Friday, February 7th, right here. Friday, February 21st, George Galster, who's a professor of planning and economist at Wayne State, will be here on his book, Driving Detroit, The Quest for Respect in the Motor City. We'll be at the William Pitt Union for that brown bag. So I think we've got a lot more students who will be coming too. One thing, and given the bankruptcy of Detroit, so George is going to be expanding to talk not just about his book, but really about what's going on with the bankruptcy and the kinds of things that have been happening in Detroit. So that'll be another interesting brown bag for us. I want to introduce Rachel Cleet, who's a professor at Ohio State in the Knowlton School and the head of the City and Regional Planning section there. Previously, she was associate professor in planning at the Evans School at the University of Washington, and received her Bachelor of Arts from Brandeis University, Master of Arts in Urban and Regional and Urban and Environmental Policy from Tufts University, and PhD in City and Regional Planning from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Wanda Wilson, who was also at Tufts, planner, cannot come. She's the director of Oakland Planning and Development Corporation with school delays today. Wanda sends her apologies. Rachel's research interests focus on housing mobility and location choice, affordable housing policy, as we'll find out today when she reports on some really interesting research on public housing authorities, housing as a poverty alleviation strategy, equity impacts of economic development, urban and regional disparities. Rachel's also on the board of the Urban Affairs Association, which we share a board seat together, and we'll be seeing each other again in San Antonio in March. She teaches courses on affordable housing policy, metropolitan policy, social equity, and advanced planning theory. Rachel, welcome to Pittsburgh.
Thank you. So let me know if, is this actually, this actually is on, isn't it?
Okay. Yes.
That way, that, well, I'll turn it this way so I don't have to stand behind the thing. So as you can see, I'm going to be talking about the changing role of public housing authorities in how we deliver housing in the U.S. And I want to just acknowledge my co-author, Steve Page, who was my colleague when I was at the Evans School of Public Affairs at the University of Washington. This is some work. So Steve and I have the office next to each other, and here I am working on housing policy. And he's doing transformation of large public bureaucracies. And we'd start talking, and I'd say, Steve, these housing authorities, we're in Seattle, and I was looking at Oregon, and these housing authorities are doing things I've never seen them do before. Why are they doing that? Why are they building all this housing? They own all this housing that's not part of the HUD stock. They are doing all these services. They're spinning off businesses to serve other housing authorities. They're being incredibly entrepreneurial. Why is this happening? He's like, well, I don't know, but let's start thinking about it. So this research stream is part of that partnership, trying to figure out both what's going on the ground, what are housing authorities doing, and also what does it mean for the transformation of large public bureaucracies. This talk is really about what they're doing, but not the bureaucracy piece of it. So I think this is what, when people think about public housing, if they're thinking about it kind of naively, this is what they think about. This doesn't exist anymore. This is Cabrini Green. In Chicago, it's been torn down, and I think the next picture is, no, it's not what it looks like now. It's been torn down, and now it's all beautiful townhomes and sand-colored brick, and a beautiful mixed-income neighborhood. It looks lovely, and but we don't have this much anymore. We've been tearing it down for the past, since 1993. How many years is that? 20 years?
Yeah, 20 plus now.
So that's one image of public housing. But in the Northwest and on the East Coast and also in the South, public housing tends to look like this, which is low-rise, sometimes duplex, sometimes two-story, stick-built. And it was built for a different purpose. It was built earlier. It was built for the war, World War II war effort. And in Bremerton, it was built because Bremerton is where the shipyards were. So it was built, there's a lovely article from 1941's Architectural Digest, which says how quickly and cheaply these buildings were built, right? And this picture, I think I blocked out the date, is from 2009. Still there, right? Or 2012, sorry. No, 2009. So it's still there, and it's small. It doesn't have a lot of the amenities that we have come to expect in quality housing now. It's very difficult to maintain. It is the Northwest. It rains a lot in the Northwest. There's a lot of mold problems there, too. So it's a much more dispersed kind of land use pattern that you'd see, say, in the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, Oregon, but I've also seen it in North Carolina, this kind of real of this kind. So what we see usually now when we talk about public housing being built is it being redeveloped into mixed income housing through, it was under the HOPE 6 program, Choice Neighborhoods is doing public housing and other kinds of housing also. But the idea is that concentrated poverty isn't good, and what we should be doing is mixing people's incomes, which I won't go into that whole theory right now, but producing housing that is looks like the neighborhood maybe we imagined we grew up in. New urbanist walkable neighborhoods, eyes on the street. Every bit of this is owned by somebody, meaning the outside is taken care of by a management company, the inside is owned either by the housing authority or individuals. Different management way. So when housing authorities, when they have their stock of housing, had a centralized management. And the new way of managing housing is by either managing it as an individual unit, individual development, the way a private manager would. Or if you have a condominiumized property, like a lot of these HOPE 6 sites are, then you have different parties taking care of different parts of the development. But that's one view of it. And these are some townhomes in New Poly, which is in Seattle, Washington. Now, HOPE 6 isn't the only way that we're building housing or redeveloping housing. We're not getting any more units. Don't get me wrong. There are no more units on average, but we are getting new housing units. So some cities, under the abilities that they were given, that housing authorities were given through the 1998 Quality Housing and Work Responsibility Act, called CORA, housing authorities have the ability to mix public housing capital dollars with private dollars to do development. In San Francisco, which is where this is, they have their own program called HOPE-SF, where the entire city, it was the Redevelopment Authority, which doesn't exist anymore, but the City Office of Housing and the Housing Authority, which is probably going to be dismantled from what I understand, for a lot of reasons, are in local government, nonprofit partners, the foundation community, including enterprise community partners, are redeveloping five of these developments of their 40-some on. Again, some of them are low-rise, maybe four-story stick-built developments into mixed-income housing. And this is one example of a courtyard in one of these new developments.
Rachel, was that Hunter's Point Bayview? Is that
that's Hunter's Point. Yeah. That's another one being built right now.
Yeah.
Right. There's another one. One of the five developments is actually a Choice Neighborhood site also. So, but this is not Choice Neighborhoods. This is just mixed finance housing. So they call it mixed finance when the housing authority does this. So there's a whole new regime here for using money, and it is a neoliberal policy, right, where we expect if we can harness private capital, we can get a lot of capital, and we can create housing that is hopefully newer, easier to manage, and will look good and reduce stigma over time. All of these things will be better. That's from the perspective of a manager. Right. We can talk about what the perspective is from individuals, but that's not what the talk is about right now. So there's another vision, though. And this is one of the pieces that began to puzzle me. So this is actually rental housing that's owned by the Bellingham Housing Authority, Bellingham-Whatcom County Housing Authority, in Bellingham, which is a rather small city in Washington State. And they built this. Some of it's tax credit, some of it isn't, but it's all affordable. So some of it has no HUD subsidy, some of it has tax credit capital to go into reducing the rents, but others of it doesn't have anything. And
is there public housing or project-based vouchers in it at all?
There might be some project-based vouchers, but not entirely. That's true, there might be some of those. Although, I took in 2007, so that was actually before project-based became something that was kind of normal, right? And so this was built in like 1993. All right, so we're talking early in the tax credit program,
right,
this kind of construction. And I hadn't known of many housing authorities that had done that. And it turns out there are some that do that. And so why? Why is this different? Why is this apple different than this apple? Or the apples? So I wanted to ask a couple questions about this, and sometimes I have to say, why should we care about housing authorities? Because I think they get a very bad rap. And frankly, there are over 4,000 housing authorities. Not all of them are active. Some of them are very small, and some of them are managed by other housing authorities. About 2,000 of them, or 2,500 of them, maybe large enough to do active management of either vouchers or public housing. They don't all have both. What I wanted to know about, though, is we have these 4,000 organizations, and sometimes they're being dismantled, and in some places they do great work delivering housing. So I think of these as a resource. If we're turning towards a means of using private capital and nonprofit organizations to build housing, why should we dismantle what could be a great resource that already exists in these communities? And sometimes is really tied very closely, usually is tied very closely to the goals of that community. And there are, of course, reasons. Right? So why do we care? So what we see are PHAs, public housing authorities, are delivering housing and services beyond HUD subsidies, which is quite interesting to me. And the other thing is that the organizational health of these agencies and their ability to manage both those subsidized units and the vouchers, and also the other units they may have, is a major influence on the preservation and the good functioning of both. And so if we don't think about that process and how we're keeping these agencies healthy, we're going to lose these units too. So what is a public housing authority? I imagine most of you may know, but sometimes people don't. So a public housing authority is a non-profit and usually quasi-public agency, housing organization that manages and has it may be a developer, and it may have developed housing in the 1950s or the 60s, or it may be doing it now. So it could just be managing housing, or it could be owning the housing and contracting out that management. They are created not by the federal government, but rather by state enabling legislation. I just had a student do a review of 50 states enabling legislation for housing authorities. She actually enjoyed it, because I'm looking for very small differences among them, right? And so there's a lot of it is boilerplate, but there are some small differences, and I get to adjust it over time. But it does matter, because different states give housing authorities different abilities. So up until like 2007, in Oregon, housing authorities could only build and own housing for low-income people at 80% of the area median income or less. In 2007, that changed, and now they can build and own mixed-income housing. In Washington State, they could do mixed-income housing, and half of their units had to benefit low-income people. So that's a very subtle difference, but it affects what an organization can do. It's really about the authorizing environment for that organization. I also think about, in Washington State, housing authorities can also bond finance. And they use that bond finance capacity a lot. So they can finance, they can act as a bank for other developers. And so they're only partially, well, it depends on where they are and who's running them and what the history is, but they're partially federally regulated. And because for so long a lot of their funding, or most of their funding, has come from the federal government, that has really controlled what they do in a lot of places. And they've become very regulated, and a lot of them are fighting the stricture. And there are there's a pilot program to remove these strictures, and other people complain they're not part of it, but so they're partially federally regulated, and most importantly, they're locally controlled. They have local commissions. And those commissions range from people in the private sector, in the business world, to city councils. The entire city council is the commission of that agency. They sometimes have a representative of the resident on it, sometimes they don't. And this commission can act very strongly to direct the direction and mission of that agency. Some places, the commission makes a lot of decisions, and in some places, the commission lets the executive director do all that. All of these things matter for what we end up with. And so we have these agencies, and we'd like to say, okay, they all do the same thing, we're implementing this policy, but all of these variables make it possible for huge variation in what we get. And so I think when you've seen one housing authority, you've only seen perhaps one, or you've seen one state's housing authority, you've seen one. And it's important to remember that your experience, what you see, is not necessarily what's happening in other parts of the country. So, housing policy has been changing. In 1930s, 1940s, housing, federal engagement in affordable housing was about affordable rental housing, where the submerged middle class, they were gonna come back from World War II and work, live in this housing for a few years and go off and buy a house in left town, perhaps. But there is about rental housing. And over time, that rental housing became focused in the late 60s on folks who were the poorest of the poor. So we had a change in rental housing policy. We had that's when the rent became set at, what was it, 25 and then 30%, right? Of the individual's income in the public housing program. And that transition from kind of the people who were, say, working poor to the folks who were in most need influenced the next 30 years of what happened in public housing, because suddenly agencies that had depended on rents for the management of this housing were dependent on HUD for a subsidy because the rents no longer covered. They had no control over the rents. So we provide rental housing as hard units, either as hard units in 1937, and vouchers became introduced in 74 and became very prominent in the 1980s. So somewhere in the 1980s, as a country, we said, those people living in that housing are poor. And gee, maybe it's not just about housing. Maybe we need to do something else. And so social services began to be integrated into housing through several experiments, and we still have those going on today as some of them are unfunded mandates through the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, with a focus on poverty reduction. We have resident services departments being created to manage these services. Sometimes housing authorities are delivering these services. Sometimes they're contracting them out. They're usually not funded. There might be a special program that's funded, like DARE was one of them, the anti-drug program was one. And that ended, everybody was upset. And then in the 1990s, we started seeing, in the 80s, we had a lot of literature in the academic world about concentrated poverty, and that led in the 1990s to a focus on mixed income housing. The HOPE 6 program was really originally about public housing redevelopment, and even some of the original sites, the first sites, were actually renovations. And the mixed income idea became integrated as a focus later on as new urbanism became a possibility for how we could think about creating what these communities might look like. So mixed income housing was about reducing the concentration of poverty and also reducing stigma. And I just want to say, these are the policy goals, and if you'd like to talk about whether those are that really is what happens, we can talk about that too. So I'm just saying that, not that necessarily that I think that's what happens, but rather those are the policy goals. And so we see income mixing through mixed income housing, but also the voucher program is renamed the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which means that suddenly people are supposed to be able to use the vouchers to have a choice about where they live, and miraculously they don't necessarily exercise a lot of huge choices when using those vouchers, which is another whole area. And we have experiments, the Moving to Opportunity program, 5 cities, quasi-experiment to see what the impact is of counseling on voucher holders in terms of where they live in a metropolitan area. And what's happened is that over time, throughout that changing role, the changing emphasis of housing policy, we've also seen a devolution. We've seen that there are larger state and local roles. So where the state might and local agencies might not have had a lot of control, we've seen more money actually at the state level and a lot of control at the state level through state housing finance agencies. And also offices of housing in localities or counties or community development. We're seeing a lot more emphasis since 1990 on the nonprofit private development. CHODOs were made a term, community housing
development organizations.
Thank you, great. We see the need for local plans in order to get money from HUD. Aimed at local decision making and local action to build housing. In 87, the low-income housing tax credit comes in, and that harnesses a lot of private capital, which nonprofits and for-profit developers can use to build housing that's not affordable necessarily on its own to people who are at lowest income, but affordable housing. And And then we also see the public housing redevelopment, which I managed, which I mentioned, starting in 1993. So having a devolution and all these things are happening. Public housing reform, CORA, 1998, which I mentioned earlier, which is the twin to welfare reform for housing. And all of this decision-making is devolved to individual authorities, to localities. So we have policies that are coming from Seattle, right?
She looks really familiar.
Everybody has a double.
It's a double game. So we have this evolved policy environment where there are lots of decisions to be made that influence what we see and how things happen. And political perspectives on the local level, the abilities of staff, the creativity of imagination of people who are working in these places matters a lot more than it did before. So we can think about what happened to public housing authorities as having been almost entirely public funded initially, to what so their managers of park units and vouchers, to being what are called in the European literature public-private hybrids. So they have partnerships, they get money from various sources, they have a public mission, but they also have some private stuff they have to do. And those things include poverty alleviation, asset management, mixed finance development, and mixed income development. And if you have questions as we go along, you can, you know, stop me. So all this devolution is happening, and in the 2000s, where my data come from, we are really unstable policy context. So in addition to all this devolution, financially, there's no stability at all. Either funding is staying the same or it's being cut. It's being in formulas for distributing money to support the voucher program is changing every year. There's no dependability in this program. There's a capital backlog because they're not funding, the federal government is not funding the capital funds at 100%. And even if they were, that probably wouldn't be adequate to deal with 50-year-old buildings. The other thing is that I showed you that picture of Cabrini Green. So that's certainly what we, I think in our minds, Cabrini Green, Pruitt Igoe, Chicago, next to big tall buildings. I don't know what public housing looks like in Pittsburgh.
Three-story walk-ups.
What, three-story walk-ups?
Yeah,
okay.
The old stuff.
So this is clears out this statement, right, that most developments are actually not huge. They're actually small.
Our biggest property in 1990 was 1,800 units of three-story
right.
walk-ups.
Right.
But,
wow, that's a big area.
So,
outside of the larger cities, which is true, most developments are small. And again, remember the local charters, commissions, and local markets influencing all of this. So that's Greenbridge in King County, Washington, Hope 6 site, built by the King County Housing Authority. So what we did was we selected, we wanted to look at, talk to housing authorities about what they were doing. And we wanted to understand initially what, why housing authorities innovated. Because that seems kind of risky to me. Why do you innovate? And we chose the 13 largest public housing authorities in Washington and Oregon, of the 61 housing authorities. Among them, these housing authorities own 1,400 units of public housing. That's 77% of the public housing stock in Washington and Oregon states. 46,000 vouchers is what they manage, 59% of the vouchers in the state. And they also own 18,000 non-HUD affordable units. And this is the number that I look at and go, wow, how did that happen? So we did a content analysis of public documents on the websites, and also in-person and telephone interviews with 20 or so executive directors, senior staff, development directors, about what they were doing and why they were doing it. And yes, I'm sorry, we did it a while ago. This has not been the easiest data set to understand, actually. And I moved a little bit. So this is, if you notice the date, though, what was happening during that time in the U.S.? There was a huge crash, right?
Yeah.
So basically, I'm talking to these folks before they know there was a crash. And I think that's an important context to remember as we look at it. Because in order for development to happen, for you to harness private dollars, you need to have a growth economy. You need to have development happening. And so this is a lot of creativity that these guys are doing in that growth economy. And just to, if you're curious about sampling distributions, so my sample of 13 housing authority out of 61 of the two states, and they're about, now, after I, they're, some of these are very small, 41,000 housing authorities, 3,500 of them are, have less than 1,000 units, are quite small. And in order to, so we can see that there are five enormous housing authorities in the U.S. We don't have any of those in Washington State or Oregon. 37, between 10,000 and 30,000 units of vouchers and public housing combined. So we have two, we have both of those. 65, next largest, between 5,000 and 10,000 units, we have one of those. Between 3,000 and 5,000 units, 74 in the US, we have five. So we took most of those. 417 at the next level. We thought these were much too small. Some, a lot of these are being managed by other housing authorities, so that you might end up in these other categories, and they're tiny. So we picked 16 of those, so not as many, but trying to get, again, the bulk of the housing covered that we saw. And what we found is that there are five, yeah, I'm very, very coordinated, as you can see. There are five paths that are parallel, well, parallel and also that housing authorities can walk down. Sometimes they walk down one, more than one path at the same time. Sometimes they choose one of them. And it really is about where they prioritize the private means, private means and their public mission. Because what they're being asked to do with neoliberal policy is, what they're being asked to do with neoliberal policy is to engage a private means, and we hope it's to produce a public good, right? And so there are these five paths. The first one is agency survival. And in order, this is kind of the overview of the talk, so if you left now, you know what I was going to say. Agency survival. So in order to do that, they need non-HUD stock because they need, they want to be, these are folks who want to be free of HUD's regulations, or they want to have most of their money coming from elsewhere so they don't have to worry about the ups and downs of the federal government, which has been going up and down since the 1980s.
Mostly down.
Mostly down. Right? Well, but, yeah, so what's interesting is this: these folks who were here in survival, they started doing development in the 80s because of those contractions. And these are also the folks who have the potential for getting out of the public housing program altogether because they want to, this is something HUD is, has a pilot program to do right now, is to transfer public housing subsidies to vouchers or vouchers to public housing subsidies to fit better into these local markets. But the idea of wanting to survive as an agency means that you might do anything to survive, or else you're going to close, or you're going to get rid of all your public housing. And the reason you might do that is because you're acting as an asset manager, and you discover that you can't make a pencil out, that you don't have the ability, with the size of the units you have, to actually make a go of it as a house. We might see some who are affordable housing developers. And because the bulk of the money coming in for affordable housing development is tax credit money, in most markets that's what they call workforce. It's kind of low workforce, but workforce housing. And some of these folks want to, some of these agencies want to build workforce housing, tax credit housing, and then after a very patient period of time have paid off all the debt and then refinance it and use that capital to build low-income housing for people who are very low-income. So far, that hasn't happened, but I think that's one of the intentions here. Some folks just do this because their commissions don't really care about delivering housing to folks who are very poor. If they care about that, they tend to, and so in these cases, the private means is kind of subsuming that public mission. But if they actually really, that they really embrace that public mission, then they diversify everything they do. They diversify, they provide housing any way they can. They're opportunistic. One housing authority, I'll talk about this later, created a, I talked about earlier, a management company that manages the Hope 6 sites of other housing authorities. They also do maintenance work, trash to pick up, other things. So they have a cost center around this, a subsidiary. And so if they're able to diversify, then they can balance that private means and the public mission. But the ability to diversify depends on the local, what's going on locally, and it depends on that chart. Some have really embraced poverty alleviation. That's what we do. We're going to alleviate poverty, and we're going to move people through our housing. We're going to give them a certain amount of time, because they're agencies that have been freed from HUD regulation, so they have some flexibility. And this is basically, we're going to change this mission, and that's where we're going to be. We're going to do that. And they're transforming who they are, a lot of them, as long as they're sure they're going to be free from regulations for a long time. And then some of them have integrated with other public entities, community, like a county department of community development, for example. And these other entities have more access to sources of funds. They may distribute home funds, for example. So they have access to other kinds of resources in their locality, which means they can actually do more in terms of attracting, using that private means and partnerships, et cetera. And they also means they have a lot more flexibility. So like the folks who diversify, they're able to balance that public and private mission a lot better. So how do we get there? I'm just going to show you some quotes from the data, because this is all quotes and all analysis of documents. So I'll give you some examples. There is a paper that I sent to Bob, so he can provide it. Yeah, go ahead. So this idea of a public purpose but a private means. So one director said, our asset management model is based on the principle that private managers have to turn a profit. That's not the same motive as nonprofit or a government agency. Nonprofit and government make more investments. So the idea is that they have a long-term interest in maintaining these properties of affordable housing. And so what happened with CORA and the regulations that followed it was that we were going to transform the way public housing was managed, so we managed more like a private business. Because that was, and so we would worry about efficiency and whether a development would pencil out and whether it could support itself. And so once you get into that mindset, you have to think about, what does that mean if we have a public mission? How does that change?
Oh, wait a minute, that's it.
All right. So again, a question about the public mission. And this is another quote from a director. The question is, how do we go to site-based management? Because the other thing that happened with CORA was that you were no longer managing everything centrally, but rather each development had its own management and its own waiting list. How do we go to site-based management and remain focused on the core mission to serve the neediest population? Some other agencies have responded to the demands from HUD by changing their focus towards workforce housing. We're going to do more of that, but it's not our core mission. One of the consequences of the federal decline in funding has been a push by HUD to get out of public housing. This has been met by two responses. The first is filling up public housing with a higher income population, and the second is simply to sell up public housing.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those last two statements that you made are the very topic and focus of what folks most fear.
Yes.
About what is
That's
what
right.
is happening.
And a director saying this.
Yes.
7 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. So it's, yeah, that's right. Absolutely. So if a housing authority is able to embrace being a developer, what does that mean? And here, my cap changed over time, so it's 18,000 units. And of these 13 housing authorities, 9 of them had low market units that they did as housing development through the 1980s. And some of these, they just purchased housing. So there's no tax credit money here. They just said, oh, look, we can buy some units. We can preserve this housing. We're going to do that. And then there are a variety of sources of funding for them. Home funds, which are distributed by localities, low-income housing tax credit, housing bonds, some of those self-issued, some of them from the state. Local housing resources, so there's a state housing trust fund, a local housing levy that goes into this. And occasionally there's capital available in the equity of those low market buildings. And 4 of them are also using mixed finance. So but a lot of it's happening before mixed finance.
So you say the equity of the buildings they own, that's the non-public housing buildings.
That's right.
Because
that's right.
You don't get to use that.
Unless you're an MTW agency.
And
which
even then
is.
It's not 30.
And which he is.
Which we are, but.
But you are, because.
But you can't.
You have to be very careful. Yeah,
that's another conversation.
But
generally, the rule is don't get equity in your public house.
That's true. That's generally the rule. Yeah. But I think, well, this is actually one of the issues with this, right? Is because we want to protect a resource that's dwindling. We want to make it better so it survives. But sometimes they're really hard for housing authorities to maintain. And so you want a redevelopment, but you have no capital to do it, especially in a down market, right? So how do you do that? Which is a problem with neoliberal policy. Okay, so what if you're a developer with a social mission? That's the other choice, right? You can be doing workforce housing, or you could think about your social mission first. Although workforce housing is a social mission, don't get me wrong, just that they're not the most needy. So a public housing authority is, 1, a real estate developer with a strong social mission that is heavily regulated. So much of what we do is real estate. We own that real estate for a reason, a public purpose, a mission, but we need to break even. And then we operate in this heavily regulated environment. Some housing authorities have reversed that paradigm. First, a heavily regulated organization that serves low-income people, and so has to go into real estate, which is that asset management model. If that's the case, then you'll operate like a HUD franchise. So I think, I knew some of these people I worked with for years, because I was a evaluator of HOPE6, and I talked to them. And one of the directors would say to me, you know, they want this HOPE6 site, this HOPE6 redevelopment to take 5 years, but it's not, it's gonna take 10. And he could care less, could have cared less about what HUD said. And I thought, wow, there's not many agents, I mean, that was not my experience coming from the places I come from, so. And other housing authorities are, one other one is buying dilapidated units, fixing them up, and selling them to make cash, to either do the same thing again, or to invest it in affordable housing. Right, see?
We should be doing that.
So this question of diversification to achieve both survival of the agency and the mission. We're not leaving our mission of serving extremely low-income people, but one way to hold on to that mission is to make a few pennies off workforce housing. That's that model I told you about. So we are connecting the both private and public partners to build workforce housing. So that's their goal. We're going to get workforce housing built, we're going to hope to get it paid off, and then we're going to hope we have some cash coming in and we can do something else. Of another agency, the executive director observed, I believe housing is opportunity-based, and we have to be positioned to take advantage of the opportunities that are out there. take advantage of state funds, federal funds, whatever funds are out there. That's what we do. So this housing authority has an enormous number of vouchers, because for many years that was the only game coming from the federal government. And so every time there was an expansion of a voucher program for a special population, they did it. And this is another agency. In 1994, the board discovered the agency had a big heart, but it was broke. The board worked through that. They needed something different. They needed more of a focus on operations and financial viability, keeping the institution solvent, so keep doing good work. Over the years, we've been able to balance things, make operational changes, but grow units to spread costs. So development to survive, but trying to think about how to balance that with the mission of the agency. And I already told you about the spin-off enterprises of that one housing authority. What if you embrace a poverty alleviation stance? We don't deliver social services, but we partner with other organizations who do. We do not want to set up a social service department. I've seen too many agencies get pulled under by it. There isn't any funding for social services. So this is kind of what I consider the traditional perspective of a housing manager, affordable housing manager, which is, you want to do services, great, but I don't know anything about that. I can't deal with that. And there's no money for it anyway. So why I can't deal with that. Overwhelmed. And this is another different perspective. Upon arriving in his agency in the mid-1990s, one executive director asked senior staff whether their allegiance was to buildings, the residents, or communities. The senior staff said their allegiance was to buildings. That's not what we're about. We're about people, about communities. So there's also a transformation that has to, if they're going to walk down this road, where housing authorities need to embrace that they're not just doing housing, which they haven't been doing just housing for a very long time, but it's taking a long time to trickle down to these agencies that are kind of path, some of them are path dependent in terms of what they do. And so some of these agencies are saying, well, we're already doing this in some ways, so they're expanding those self-sufficiency programs we talked about. Some housing authorities, not in this sample, but for example, Charlotte, North Carolina, is very innovative in terms of doing housing self-sufficiency programs that are meant to help people gain assets over time. And this notion of integration of the powers, so the city council is the commission. That's one way of integrating it, which one housing authority has. It is the housing authority is a designated community revitalization agency under state law, and actually has done a cleanup of an Arsaco site, a copper polluted Superfund site in the state of Washington. One is integrated, there are two that are integrated with county departments to expand their abilities. And one of these places, I think, owns like 2,000 units of unsubsidized but low market housing. So one of those, one of them says, we thought we had to do things differently from traditional PHAs. And this was not the way it was going to be in the future. So we decided to take a very long-term strategy. What we went to do is play Robin Hood economics. What we would do is use our board finance, our bond financing ability, leverage tax credits, and use all those tricks to create affordable housing that would be part of our inventory and that we would have control of. At first, the rent was for the working poor, but over time, we stratified that. Now our rents are $200 below market, and over time, we've created a supply of permanently affordable housing without government assistance. Why I studied this, right? So I think there's a tarnished silver lining to the story, which is that we've learned, I think what I learned from this, is that PHAs can own and develop stock outside of HUD. And some of these folks have been doing this for 20 years. And they can take a variety of local roles, if empowered to do that, and other kinds of politics are involved, of course. But because of funding source and the mostly growing workforce sector, they're not doing that, building that housing necessarily where there's the most need, which is true of all of our affordable housing policy in the US generally. So that's not surprising. So if a housing authority depends on Section 8 and public housing to survive, they're not going to. What is sad is that the poorest of the poor are getting left out. It isn't penciling out at 30 to 40% of AMI. They can't build housing at that rate. And those are the folks with the most need in most markets, nationally. Well, we're helping the rich poor. We're requiring for lots of units, but not at deep subsidy levels. No one is talking about it because no one has a solution to it. It takes a lot of capital to bring the rents down. Housing authorities can tap into capital, but it isn't the massive amounts of capital required to provide those deep subsidies. So, okay, that's nice. We can build housing, which is awesome, actually, completely awesome to do that. But still, this question of why do we have such diverse responses? Because I think people have very different experiences. So there are a few hypotheses that arrived from this research. One is that, so I said some of these had been doing this kind of development since the 80s. So there's an uneven timing of responses, which is uneven among PHAs in different parts of the country, due to differences in those state charters, local market pressures, the choices of the boards, executive directors, and key staffs. And what I don't know is which of those is most important, which is why I think you might have missed it. We're doing two things now. One is, I have a wonderful RA who patiently went through all of the enabling legislation for the 50 states to look for minor differences that might have an impact on this kind of innovation. And now we also, if you're from, you're going to find out, we just sent out a web survey to the membership of the Public Housing Directors Association, asking for information about any units that they, whether they have developed housing outside the HUD stock and what that looks like, because it's very hard to track that, actually. We're going to match that information up with publicly available information from the preservation database, from HUD resources, to try to understand and model what's going on here. The dependence of a public housing authority and HUD program and state charter and the degree of integration with local government all contribute to its level of activity in using private means to develop housing. So once we've done the survey and we have a sense of what's going on nationally, then we'll be able to think about, well, what are the stories we need to tell? What do we need to look into more? And we'll choose some case studies and do that. And if all is well, there'll be a couple papers and a book that will argue that we shouldn't be dismantling this precious resource because it can be quite important in delivering housing in the current structure because it is like a locally controlled developer. And just to give you an idea of the diversity of responses here, so each of the, across the top of those four paths, right, we have, oh, this is not for them to do this. Oh, can you, I don't want to touch anything. No, okay. Okay, so we have path one, agency survival, path two, development of workforce housing, diversify, poverty alleviation, other government powers. And these are the 13 housing authorities that I studied. And so a good six of them are focused on agency survival. But they're also trying to develop workforce housing, and maybe they're going to diversify, maybe not, right? But not all of them are. And some of them have also embraced the poverty alleviation mission. So they're doing things on multiple fronts, except for this one, which really is really saying, okay, I just want to do workforce housing. We don't care about poor people, really poor people. And then these folks are really just focusing on workforce housing and hoping to diversify if they're lucky. Not everyone has embraced that poverty alleviation mission, and only and four of them have figured out a way to tap into other government powers. So it's a confusing story to tell. So that is my story.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel. Mm-hmm. We might be asked to go back to that slide, I think, at some point. But that's
I'm happy to do that.
Yeah. Let's open it up for questions. I think we're going to have some good discussion about some of this. And could you identify yourself when you ask the question, Nathan?
Sure. I'm Nathan Dorfman. I'm a master student at Gispia. So I'm curious.
Gispia is the graduate
that's
school.
That's my school, yeah.
School.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So you mentioned how public housing authorities are not built in areas with the greatest need sometimes, and I'm curious what can be done to incentivize the building.
Money.
In
you think I'm so in the federal government? I just gave this lecture yesterday. We fund people who earn $100,000 or more to the tune of $7,000 a household. That's how much benefit they get in housing.
Okay.
People who earn $30,000 or less get about $1,200 a household on average. and that's not going to all houses. It's only serving a quarter of the households who have the most need. So we have a system that is set up to produce inequitable benefits. And the housing authorities are trying to work in this incredibly inequitable system. And some of them are part of this, and that also produces different responses. There was a question over here.
Yeah. Chuck Keenan and I work at the Allegheny County Department of Human Services. I've wondered if you looked at all in your research at the effect of the abolishment of the federal preferences in the 90s to see how that affected some of the housing authorities.
No, I haven't looked at that. That's a very good question. Now, what I have done is we've asked you about local preferences. Because that's what replaced those, right?
Right.
So, yeah, the question of whether they have engaged in preferences or not. So local preferences are, it's up to the discretion of the housing authority to concentrate on particular populations. So the ones that I'm familiar with are focused on homelessness, housing cost burden, severe housing cost burden, paying more than 50% of your income for rent.
Living in substandard housing.
Living in substandard, yeah. So they're kind of going through all the
they were like rewarding, not bad behavior, but really bad situations. So the worse your situation was, the easier it was to get
that's
housing
right.
back then.
That's right.
Now it's kind of
well, they kept those preferences, though, this particular housing code.
Oh, some of them did?
Some, yes, they used their local discretion because they're locally chartered agencies. So some of them kept it. Go ahead.
Art Maxwell, independent consultant. On that last slide, how did you code those X's? What behavior or what did you observe that said this guy's here? Because what I see is a lot of them are all over the place.
Yeah, they're all over the place. That's why it's difficult to make a choice. It's basically based upon what they said about, this is based upon the conversation with them about their stance, their organizational stance and what they were trying to do. And they had several different strategies they were trying to take. And so this is an effort to make the strategies make some sense in terms of organizational behavior. So you're right, the X's are all over the place, and these guys could be the same column, right? These three might be the same column, but that wouldn't tell you about what they're doing, right? Because what I want to know is, what are they doing? How can I, if someone who is in policy circles or working for a housing authority nationally were to read this paper, I want them to understand the choices that are available to them and where they're going to end up. So this allows me to tell that story. But you're right. These are all 13 housing authorities, right? And so they have, and they're all working in a very similar policy environments. So it's not surprising that these are so similar, which is one reason these hypotheses are kind of like, well, okay, so that's nice. What do we know? What do we really know? You know? Because these are, some people would say and have said that, oh, but it's the Pacific Northwest. They're more innovative there anyway. But, you know, I have a former student who works in, her first job was for, in Boulder, Colorado, working for a subsidiary or partner agency to the housing authority there that was created as a nonprofit to build housing. Right? That's pretty innovative, I'd say. So, Montgomery County Housing Authority, it's not a housing authority, it's called the Housing Opportunities Commission. They've been building mixed income housing, building it and also buying it from the county. Since the 1970s.
Montgomery County, Maryland.
And they are, that was my dissertation site, and they've been using their bond financing ability to do that. So those are the, I want to understand that if we have a particular set of abilities or have a particular stance, where are we going to end up? Because I want to understand what the product of policy is going to be. That's what I want to know. And right now, it's very hard to predict. Well, the prediction is we will have less affordable housing for people with very low income. And so if I want to chart a path to say, well, there's another way of doing this. Let's think about another way of doing this. Then I need to think a more varied picture of that. But you're right. It is all over the place. It's my attempt to make sense of it. There was another hand up.
Sure.
Go ahead.
My name is Trevor Armstrong. I'm the director of the Studies Program. I enjoyed this talk because it really transformed my understanding of the scales at which decisions are being made. The fragmentation, which I think in this case is a good thing, permitting a huge amount of experimentation. So I'm imagining a very diverse landscape of activities.
Right.
So my question is somewhat related to the PATH 4 poverty alleviation mission, which really extraordinary public mission.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could, this may be outside the parameters, I'm sure it's outside the parameters of what you're doing, but this could be aligned with a goal that is a component of sustainability.
Absolutely.
And I'm interested in whether or not you could talk maybe about ways in which goals of sustainability are being thought about as primary mission components of public housing authorities. And if I can give just a couple of examples of things.
Wait, can I let you know what you
said? There are the following. Poverty alleviation, great, a wonderful goal, I believe. I'm wondering if there are other experiments in thinking about how to build, other than, for example, the one you gave, which is looking at new urbanism as a model. So there are a number of European instances that
sure,
I'm familiar with,
absolutely.
Such as co-housing.
Yeah.
And so from the point of view of having a sustainable mission, it was more complex about how the housing stock functioned. Co-housing is one instance of a different sort of configuration. Then there's an infrastructure question, which also has, to my knowledge, more European models, which are things like district heating as a way of dealing
yeah.
with problems
right.
of emissions
sure.
and reducing costs.
Yeah.
I'm only using those examples to get at whether or not we are seeing more complex mix in the new built stock.
Okay, so first question really has to do with how people live together and how the units are owned and managed, right? And in some places there has been some experimentation. I think co-housing has not, so co-housing communities in the U.S., from what I understand, have not been affordable necessarily. Some of them are, and there's one I know of. Yeah. It's the Ravenna Cookbooks. So they're usually communities of people who want to live together, and they build a development together or find a neighborhood together, and they have a common property where they can cook together and help each other out, either with the child care in there, common space. So that's co-housing. It's usually people who can afford to do that do it. And so that I haven't seen that. Doesn't mean that it's not happening. But I have seen a mutual housing association. There was a nonprofit partner in one of Seattle Housing Authority's redevelopments, Westwood Heights. There was a high-rise Westwood Heights, which was low-income, and then a low-rise building. And they partnered with a nonprofit, the Lutheran Alliance for Housing, LARCH, whatever C is, Council for Housing. And it just does not have a name, but LARCH tried to run a mutual housing association. It was a mixed income mutual housing association. And they had a lot of trouble with that. And I don't know what all the trouble was about. But certainly in the nonprofit world, there's a lot of experimentation with cooperative, limited equity co-ops. So if you go to Boston, Fenway CDC, lots of the CDCs there are associated with cooperatives, limited equity cooperatives. In Seattle, there's some, or they call it shared equity now, not limited equity. Shared equity condominiums, also. Because one of the nonprofits in Seattle became a community development bank finance agency, and is now able to finance its own housing programs for folks. And so, if you have an environment of that kind of creativity going on in your housing authority, you might have a different set of responses also, right, than you would otherwise. There's also, there's de-restricted housing in the U.S. Again, I have not seen housing authorities doing that necessarily. Sometimes there's a discussion when building the new mixed income housing, if you have affordable housing, affordable homeownership opportunities, should there be a shared equity part of that? I think, I don't know what the response has been nationally. The one person I talked to about this said that she thought it should be a 10-year limit and then they should get the windfall afterwards. Why should we limit their equity? Because nobody else's equity is limited. Which is another argument to have about the use of public dollars. Your second question had to do with kind of the infrastructure of this. So again, and because I lived in Seattle, I have this knowledge, but otherwise. So the High Point Public Housing Redevelopment, New High Point, has won awards for its green building. They have a couple of different things going on. One of them, because the site had a water problem, which is not surprising to Seattle, they built a very large water retention pond, and then all of the sidewalks and areas are all porous. So if you pour water on a surface, it goes right down into that pond. So they really thought about how to build that into the site. There were bioswales and greenery everywhere. They have also, there's a, the local Department of Public Health partnered with them for a healthy housing, healthy housing program, smart housing. So basically, these healthy homes, and these are homes that have, that are built to reduce exposure to environmental toxins. So they have hardwood floors, and they have, there's no smoking in them. They have, the upholstery is not going to off gas. Paints are not going to off gas. The ventilation, and the idea is to reduce the prevalence or the complications for children with asthma, basically. And there are about 25 of these healthy homes, and Jim Krieger, he's the epidemiologist in the King County Department of Health, is the one who's responsible for that. There are other things about New Holly, but unfortunately, but if you look up, not New Holly, High Point, you'll find, you can follow their award trail. So where you can see. Other questions?
Rachel, when, I mean, you only have 13, we know them only, but 13 case studies here. Is there getting, I mean, when you go out to do the survey, are you suspecting there's some kinds of relation among size of the housing authorities?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think what it is, if you're very large, you don't have to change as quickly.
Okay.
Because you have you have a lot more money coming in from HUD subsidies. Mm-hmm. You have a lot more capital coming in. And if you have a lot of public housing. And even if it's fluctuating, it's still more than folks who don't have a lot of it. So I think if you didn't have a lot of public housing, and if you had a small stock, that you were more likely to do things earlier. That's one of the hypotheses also that comes from this. It's true.
Okay. So young, smaller, more entrepreneurial, and
yeah, unless they're in a jurisdiction where they're just simply where they
just
believe
vouchers.
You know, where they believe that the private market will do everything. So housing authorities should not be building anything.
And they just do vouchers.
They have a commission that believes that we have enough poor people in this community. We don't need to build more housing for them. True. These are both true housing. Yeah, both.
Are you going to look at how much the flexibility of moving to work has helped some of those agencies?
Because
I know that King County and
Seattle and Portland
are all moving. To
that's
work.
Right. That's right. But Tacoma isn't. Right. Wimby just became one.
Yeah,
recently.
But they did stuff about
it. They did stuff about it, yeah. So, and Bellingham did stuff about it. So, yeah, I will look at that. I think that does affect a lot of the development they can do, certainly. I think the experimentation around self-sufficiency programs and ways of doing asset building are
right.
Also things that have happened because of MTW. So that will be something they have to look at, yeah.
Also look at the amount of funding resources that are available to those agencies. If they have MTW, if they're running earlier block grant agencies,
right. That's right.
They have more money.
They have more money. Right. Now, this is, it's, yeah, the resources are misdirected.
Following up on those two questions, I think I found out that all these policies, and I don't care if it was a Hope 6 or Choice Neighborhoods or Moving to Work, at some point, all these agencies are looking at them in a different light. They're interpreting them in different ways, and no one agency is interpreting the policy the same way, which has created a humongous craziness among housing authorities. Even here in Pennsylvania, state of Pennsylvania,
yeah.
They do not interpret the same policy to say the same thing. And for advocates, it's been a very hard challenge focusing on policy and having a good policy that it will enable the recipients of these different things to be truly helped. And so we struggle in the policy mandate of all these things and trying to figure out, because they're always changing before they get halfway through something, they're changing the policy.
Right.
They're changing how it
right.
how it works.
Because they actually don't have the discretion.
Thank you. You know,
there's this very odd tension, right? That in some ways you want to control what they're doing because you want to know what the outcome's going to be. And you want to be able to understand that if you do X, Y happens. But it's the HUD's regulations have for many years stuff like one size fits all. And one size doesn't fit all. And so the moving to work program, which, as one of my colleagues said, is not about moving and not about work.
Yeah.
It's about relieving, relieving housing authorities of some of the regulations they have to work on, that they work under, and allowing them to combine different funds for different purposes. So capital dollars with
But the
offset to that is that it is a demonstration program,
yeah.
And it still hasn't been evaluated to say
it was evaluated
after the first 14 again, you know, we fought hard for no more moving to work agencies because of the fact that
right. There
really weren't no there really was no data to support whatever the claim was.
That's right. The only thing we learned from the first, there was an evaluation done on the first 14 agencies that the Urban Institute did. And the only thing that I can remember from that evaluation was agencies were unwilling to innovate and make changes because they thought they would have to go back to the old system anyway. So that's one of the reasons it stayed for so long, to give housing authorities that were involved the assurance that if they made a change, it would stay and happen. But you're right, there's a,
there's a center in budget and policy always has been asked them, you know,
right, absolutely.
And banging their heads for it, you know, and trying to make it happen. I mean, understandably, you know, moving to work has some good parts to it and everything else, but again, just understanding that, you know, how they can interact and how they can do things as opposed to a traditional housing authority.
Yeah.
You know, we found it out with the sequestration that took place between the city housing authority and the county housing authority. You know, they were crying at the county, and the city was saying, well, we're not as much affected, you know what I mean? So you had that whole other thing going on.
I guess one of the things I ponder, I don't know what to do about this, is that the neoliberal regime, which says, okay, we don't have, well, if you're the most positive light on this, is we don't have enough resources from the federal government to solve the problem. So we're going to tap into the private market to do this, right? So in order to do that, we need a lot of discretion. And so that's, I think, one of the motives for that MDW piece. Mm-hmm. However, if the private market is failing you, which in some cases, so what's ending up happening is we're redeveloping the most viable developments, leaving the ones that are not viable behind without any solution for them. So we're going to end up with a lot of worse public housing after this. That's what the stocks. So it's a dilemma, it's a political dilemma, as you know, right? And what?
It's not just a dilemma for the housing authority, it's a dilemma for the community.
Yeah.
As well.
Right, absolutely.
And now that there's a whole lot of people looking out for the community.
That's right.
Because there's no one-for-one replacement, there's no.
Well, there is, not on. But the city could demand that. Right? The city could say, hey, you're not going to get any utilities from us unless you do one-for-one replacement. The city could do that.
Political.
Right, it's political.
I think because of the cuts that the housing authorities are seeing, they got to do whatever they can to survive.
Right.
And they've got to make themselves right size. They can't have a bunch of vacant units sitting
That's
around,
right.
and they can't do a bunch
That's
of
right.
other things. So.
Well, the right, I think the right sizing, this piece of trading vouchers for units or vouchers is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because it does allow them to right size, as long as the vouchers don't go away. Because right? the subsidies could go away.
I'm David Weber. My title is Government Relations and Special Services Officer for the Housing Authority. So I just want to sort of context for Pittsburgh a little bit. You know, one of the things, you know, the Housing Authority is a moving to work agency, didn't really get into, did some scattered site development, I guess, in the early
80s. Yeah. Can I just add something about that?
Yeah.
So a lot of housing authorities did scattered site development in the 80s, and those are the most expensive units to maintain, right?
Well, that's sort of what everyone says, although in Pittsburgh that's not necessarily been
okay,
the case.
Okay, that's good. Seattle
been a very sick in the city.
Seattle's
about 300 units scattered all across the city. It's one of our most successful portfolios at this point. But didn't do any of the larger scale development, partly as Chuck Lugo, right-sizing it. We had a shrinking city, a shrinking market. Housing demand was, generally speaking, low. So there wasn't really opportunity. And even now, we try to get private developers, we try to offer project-based vouchers as an incentive to create development of affordable units. And it, as you say, it doesn't pencil out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rents aren't high enough to cover the cost of a unit that's going to cost you $200,000 to build. So, you know, so that's a challenge. Now, that's sort of been changing a little bit, and we've done what we can to try to work that. But, you know, there's definitely been both financial and political resistance to doing some of the, and institutional resistance to doing some of the more entrepreneurial kinds of things that other agencies have done. And including, you know, the sort of union structures that we work in make it more difficult to be flexible with how you deliver maintenance services, for example. So there are all those challenges that are also part of it. But I think the local market and those recognitions have a huge impact on what agencies do.
That's right. I think it's also the market, but I think it's also a trust factor also for some places.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're just like, they don't trust the housing authority for whatever reason. And you can be like the best. you can be the highest functioning housing authority in the nation, and still your locality will not trust you. You can be financing housing all over your city using your bonds, and still you're not trusted.
Well, I think, excuse me if you're not identifying George Moses, community advocate. I think, you know, as much as Dave and I and Chuck and others in this room go back and forth, you know, we see at the bottom end of our thing is the people who the housing authority is supposed to serve. You know, so when you see a housing authority that has went from a huge housing stock back in the 90s to a third of that now and is slated to lose more, but within the city of Pittsburgh as a whole, because of our aging stock and everything else, there's a huge there's a huge demand still for affordable housing. So, you know, I think we are always challenged with how do we work with the housing authority, because we have a growing also homeless population. So how do we increase housing for all in the arena when we see the housing authority and some of its policy things that it do create obstructions to what we're trying to do, you know what I mean? And they will know, we show up to their hearings on things, it'd be just me and Chuck. You know, Peter used to come every now and then.
I don't even come anymore.
You know, but that was the thing. So, you know what I mean? It's how do you go through all that policy structure and change that most of us down here don't even have a clue about, and be able to work effectively with a housing authority who is still trying to figure it out itself.
So I think it is political, but it, meaning that you need to have someone, you need people in office care, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the other piece is that you need to find other resources that can supplement what the housing authority is doing. And those other resources can be a housing trust fund, it can be a levy, they can be nonprofits that do what the housing authority could start, community land trust. Why not?
Yeah, you know? I mean, and there's also some willingness to take some risk with new initiatives. I think the housing authority, you know, they've got their, this is what we do, sort of
that's
been
right.
very hesitant
that's
to
right.
venture out because someone might get mad and call the newspapers.
Yeah,
me!
So this is part of it though, right? So if you're going to be a partner, be a partner. You know? So I just want to add one other thing, is that I don't know what your rental market is like here. And whether it's a soft market, whether it's a lot of demand. So if the soft market, maybe building isn't the smartest thing, maybe you do want to have a lot of vouchers. And maybe what the locality should be doing is saying, okay, instead of giving you money to build housing, we're going to fund vouchers for the next 20 years. Well, maybe that's what's going to happen. New York has
well,
a
difficult
to
pass
Massachusetts.
Because
of
yeah, well, that's the other thing.
Well,
there's
great.
The issue about it's the availability of quality, decent, affordable housing. There's lots of affordable housing, just a lot of it won't pass inspections.
He was talking about incentives earlier, right? So maybe one of the incentives is, hey, if you renovate your housing, and we'll give you a little funding to do that, we'll help you with that. You have an extension agent. And what they do is they go to landlords. They say, do you need help fixing up this unit? You fix it up, this is what we're going to do. We're going to set you up with a stable source of rent. Right? And you're going to have this great relationship with the housing authority, which some housing authorities have, great relationships with landlords. So you can be... I've never seen anybody do this, but you do have the ability to do it if you have partners and you think creatively about the resources that you have. But you still have dwindling resources. So that sounds great, right? But maybe there's a local foundation community that cares about this. And, yeah, that's that's how I know you. From the foundation world. I
can't argue. Yeah, they don't trust the housing authority.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. And so what does it mean to have people collaborating with each other rather than trying to compete with each other to figure out who's doing the right thing? I guess is the question. Like this competition way of working, you're a bad guy, you're the good guy, is not getting us anywhere, and it's basically tearing, it's making it harder to use the resources we have.
I think that just building off of that, I think HUD has realized with its privately owned multifamily stock that they were losing an enormous amount of stock at an alarming rate, affordable housing. And so now they have went into this whole tenant resource network, and as a result of trying to save that stock, offering incentives and others to refurbish, rehab it, and do it as opposed to knocking it down and losing that stock. And so in somehow or another trying to translate what that is happening into the public housing arena as well, because again, we're across this nation, we're using an affordable, alarming rate of stock, a good stock, you know, without replacing part of it. So how do you, as Dave always tries to do, how do you balance that in a great world when you have this need that is really out there.
So what do we need?
Besides
we
money.
Need a welfare state.
Besides money.
Because we have, this is my, we have a capitalist economy, there's market failure in a capitalist economy. Let's face it, folks, we're not going to be able to serve them. Mm-hmm. No. But that's not what our ideology is as a country.
Well, I think one of the good things for students to know, it doesn't matter what you're building, as David said, $200,000 for a unit. I'm thinking about, for students, like to hear the numbers of how much it costs to build a unit.
Why does it cost that?
That's why we look at preservation as opposed to building new.
Or some other forms that Drew was talking about, in different forms of housing construction.
Right. That's right. It's not about the construction. It's about the paperwork. So how many different sources of funding does the housing have to get built? And there are lawyers involved and a whole professional class that we have that deals with this. We've done the same thing in healthcare. We do this in healthcare too. We just created healthcare just like we have the housing system. So
say we're not talking about tax credit.
But that's where the money, but that's one of the money goes to the tax credit deals, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. So it's not just the construction, and it's not just the land, it's the bureaucracy involved. But it's also that when you build affordable housing, you're not building it for 5 years. You want to build it for 50 or 60 years. So hopefully you are spending, maybe it's a little bit of construction, but hopefully you're spending money on stuff that's durable. So you don't have huge capital costs during the management.
Rachel, I want to thank you for a very compelling talk and great discussion, as always. For everyone, don't forget, we've got Randy Walsh on the 7th of February, and we've got George Golster talking about Detroit on his book, Driving Detroit, The Quest for Respect in the Motor City, plus George is going to be reflecting on Detroit's bankruptcy and some things that are different there, obviously. So, thanks again, and we'll see you in a few weeks.